Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 75 years ago today, September 2nd, 1945, Japan formally surrendered to the United States and its allies to end World War II. Between 50 and 80 million people died during the war. That includes civilian as well as military deaths. More than 418,000 Americans were killed. It was one of the planet's greatest calamities. The war set a course for great changes in the world that are felt even today. On today's program, we look back to 75 years ago to the legacy of World War II. We'll also speak with a 93-year-old veteran of the Pacific War. Joining us today, Dr. Tammy Davis Biddle, Professor of Military Studies at the U.S. Army War College at the Carlisle Barracks. Dr. Biddle, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. I'm delighted to be here.
Also, retired Army Colonel Don Boos, former professor of strategy of World War II in the Pacific, also at the U.S. Army War College, the Carlisle Barracks. Colonel Boos, glad to have you on the program.
I'm glad to be here, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, this is one of our history programs. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Facebook, you can leave, that's WITS Facebook, you can leave a question or comment. On Twitter, we are at @SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Colonel Boos, I'm going to start with you. What exactly happened on September 2nd, 1945?
Well, Scott, on that day, Japanese representatives, along with U.S. General Douglas MacArthur, who was to be the supreme commander of the Allied powers that would occupy Japan, and the military representatives of those powers signed a document whereby the Empire of Japan surrendered unconditionally to the Allies. And that event took place on board the battleship USS Missouri, flagship of the U.S. Third Fleet. And that fleet had steamed into Tokyo Bay with an armada of 258 Allied warships the previous day. The Missouri on that day flew two American flags. One was the flag that had flown over Commodore Perry's flagship when he entered Tokyo Bay on July 8, 1853 on a diplomatic mission, the first one in the United States and Japan, and another flag that had flown over the U.S. Capitol building on December 7, 1941 at the time of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. On hand for the ceremony, in addition to a lot of sailors and Marines and journalists, in addition to the Japanese and the Allied representatives, were Lieutenant General Jonathan Wainwright, who had surrendered the Philippines in May 1942, and British Lieutenant General Sir Arthur Percival, who had surrendered Singapore in February of that year. Those two men had been prisoners of war and had been flown in from a prisoner of war camp in Manchuria. The Japanese delegation was headed by Foreign Minister Shigemitsu Mamoru, and the delegation arrived at about 9 o'clock to sign the instrument of surrender. Foreign Minister Shigemitsu represented the Japanese government. General Umezu Yoshijiro, Chief of the Army General Staff, signed on behalf of the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters. After they signed the document, General MacArthur then signed, followed by the military representatives of the United States, China, the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union, Australia, Canada, France, the Netherlands, and New Zealand. After the signing, an air fleet of 450 U.S. Navy aircraft and 462 Army Air Force B-29 bombers flew over the Missouri. The surrender of Japanese forces elsewhere in Southeast Asia, Manchuria, and the Pacific Islands would take place over the next days and weeks. But the signature of the instrument of surrender on September 2nd officially ended the war. And that war had begun with the Japanese attack on China in 1937, and as you say, had caused tens of millions of military and civilian deaths. The Emperor of Japan had made the decision to surrender after the destruction of most of Japan's major cities by firebombing, the total blockade of the home islands, the detonation of two atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and 9th, the invasion of Manchuria by Soviet forces on August 9th, and with an immense American amphibious force preparing to invade. So the war and the way in which it ended vastly transformed the world.
We're going to talk about that, but some of the things that you just described, I have some questions about. Many in the United States celebrated VJ, Victory Over Japan Day, not on September 2nd. Why?
Well, the process, Japanese decision-making process, and the process of preparing for the official surrender of Japan took place in stages. On August 10th, the Japanese had indicated. Let me go back a little earlier. In July, there had been a conference at Potsdam in which the United States and Britain had made a declaration to the Japanese calling upon them to surrender or to face terrible destruction. The Japanese had not made a satisfactory response to that, but the other events that I had mentioned took place that finally caused the Emperor of Japan to make the decision to surrender. On the 10th of August, there had been a preliminary message about the circumstances of the surrender. And then on the 15th of August, the emperor made an announcement to the people of Japan that the country was surrendering. He didn't say they were surrendering. He said circumstances in the war have not necessarily gone to our advantage. But it was clearly the emperor was announcing that Japan was surrendering. And so 15 August is widely celebrated as VJ Day. But it was not until the 2nd of September that an actual document was signed by the representatives of the Japanese government.
Many in the United States look at the start of World War II as December 7th, 1941, when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. But something you mentioned that many may not know or be aware of is China. And as you said, Japan had been fighting in China for years. And if you look at the casualty figures, China has maybe the biggest, I'm not absolutely sure, but more people killed in China than anywhere else. Also, what you had mentioned about the Allies, I think that many people are aware that Australia fought in the Pacific, but some of the other nations, the other Allies, how much did they add to fighting in the Pacific against Japan? I know there's two questions there.
Oh, sure. The first question was the beginning of the war. How do you count the beginning of the Second World War? And in the Asia-Pacific, generally, it is considered that when the Japanese attacked China in 1937 was the beginning of the war, that from that time, 1937 until 1945, the Asia-Pacific region was convulsed by war. Some would go even earlier. The first real act of aggression by the Japanese was in 1931, when they went on the attack in Manchuria, an area that they had had strong interest in. They had fought a war with Russia in 1904-1905 over control of Manchuria. And in 1931, a Japanese force that was located in Manchuria attacked and over the next several months captured all of Manchuria, the north of China, a huge area north of China. And from then until 1937, there had been uneasy border between the Japanese-occupied Manchuria and China. And then in 1937, the Japanese went on the offensive in China. The other part of your question was about the other countries that were involved. Well, of course, China had been, say, been fighting that war since 1937, and as you mentioned, had incurred enormous casualties. And they had continued to fight throughout the war, and a major U.S. effort during the war was to keep China in the war and to support China, in part because much of the Japanese army was in fighting in China, and while the Chinese continued to fight, the Japanese were diverted by that. A large part of the Japanese army was also, by the way, located in Manchuria, facing the Soviet Union. That's a whole other story, but the Soviet Union was in fact neutral until right up at the until the end of the war when they made their attack. But the Japanese also always had to consider the possibility of war with the Soviet Union, and so had to maintain forces in Manchuria. Now, on December 7, 1941, the Japanese not only attacked Pearl Harbor, but they also attacked the British colony of Malaya and the Dutch East Indies. Before the war, all of Southeast Asia, except for Thailand, was occupied by colonial powers. The United States had a colony. Philippines was a colony of the United States. The British controlled Burma, Malaya, and Singapore, and the and several of the islands in Southeast Asia. And the Dutch had a substantial empire in what was then called the Dutch East Indies, or the Netherlands East Indies, what is today Indonesia. And so when the Japanese attacked, they went to war not just with the United States, but also with the Dutch and with the British. And, of course, when they went to war with the British, they were also going to war with Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and India. We might talk later more about that. The Indians did not have a representative at the surrender ceremony, but an enormous number of soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Indian forces fought in the Pacific in World War II.
Dr. Biddle, I want to talk in a moment about the atomic bombs and the impact it had then and even to this day. But what was the condition, what were the conditions in the Pacific leading up to those two bombs being dropped just the weeks before Japan decided to surrender?
Sure, Scott. First, let me just say that the surrender on the 2nd was a momentous event, and as you could tell from Don's wonderful explanation, it was meant to display American power.
Oh, a lot of symbolism there.
Tremendous symbolism, with the flag that had flown over the Capitol on December 7th, and then Commodore Perry's flag, and the immense flotilla that entered Tokyo Bay, displaying the great power of the Allied navies and just the tremendous power base that the United States was working from at that point. And then, of course, that overflight of aircraft, which was just a tremendous display of dominance, being led off by the B-29, which was an extraordinary airplane for its era. It had really been a great leap into the future in terms of every capability that it had, in terms of range and ability to carry bombs, and just everything about it was so futuristic compared to anything that had been available in the year that it was first conceived, in 1940. So what happened in Tokyo Bay was really the rise to the front of the international stage of the United States, of course with her allies, but this war had been really an American war. The Pacific War was driven by our resources and our capabilities, and that had gathered slowly. You know, we had taken some time to get ourselves together after Pearl Harbor. We had not particularly wanted to be in the war. We were a very divided nation in 1940 and 1941 with respect to whether to fight Hitler, what to do about Japan. We were very unhappy about the Japanese expansion in the Pacific region, but we hadn't moved in the direction of direct conflict with them. We were trying to negotiate a settlement when the surprise attack came. And then so everything thereafter in the years from 1942 through 1944 and then into early 1945 was to take back territory that had been lost, to gain strength, to develop the war economy and the industrial might and the weapons of war, to be able to take back the Japanese Empire from them. And once they had consolidated it in 1942, that was no small task. So it took a huge effort. But then by late 1944 into 1945, the stage was set. Americans were producing incredible instruments of war in terms of aircraft and ships and submarines. And we had been able to really, by 1944, start to completely turn the tables and dominate the fight. And so what had happened in Japan in the years right before, or in the period right before the atomic bomb, had been an extensive air campaign waged against Japan, initially from China, aircraft that were located in China being staged out of India and supplied by resources in India. It was sort of a crazy idea logistically, but it was the best way to get at Japan at that point. Those airplanes, B-29s in particular, had a limited ability, limited range to be able to hit the parts of Japan, but they could get there. And then once we had liberated the Marianas, we could stage out of places like Tinian and Guam and fly. It was a very long haul up to Japan, but we had more access over the Japanese islands flying out of those bases. And using this new instrument, the B-29, which was such a remarkable aircraft, we had begun a serious bombing campaign. And that had been really, initially it started off in a similar way as the campaign in Europe, which was to go after Japanese industrial might. But it had proven very difficult to do precision, anything remotely like precision bombing in Japan, because of the jet stream winds, which made holding formation very difficult, and the heavy cloud cover over Japan much of the time. And so the air campaign was making only limited headway until March of 1945, when a young general, General Curtis LeMay, decided to, under pressure from Washington, by the way, decided to change tactics and began a nighttime air campaign against Japanese cities using incendiary bombs in particular, and really trying to raise Japanese cities in an effort to get at their war industry, also demoralize them, and hopefully, if it could be done, defeat them before it would be necessary to invade the home island. Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
I was going to say, I want to take a break, but you know what you described, island hopping to try to get closer to Japan. And you know, one of the things that's striking 75 years later is, obviously, this is not a pleasant conversation, but, you know, it's one of those things. I'm learning so much just, and I'm sure our audience is too, the cloud cover, the jet stream. These are things that you don't read about in the history books for the most part. Maybe at the War College you do, but most American students ever haven't over the years. We'll talk more about it in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. On tomorrow's Smart Talk, the proposal to offer paid family leave during the pandemic, and also the coin shortage during the pandemic. But today we're talking about the 75th anniversary of the surrender of Japan to the United States, September 2nd, 1945. 17-year-old Herb Morrow of Carlisle enlisted in the Navy on September 3rd, 1944. As a seaman first class, he was assigned to the light cruiser the USS Birmingham that sailed from San Francisco to Iwo Jima just as the battle for that island between U.S. Marines and Japanese soldiers was heating up. I had the opportunity to speak with Mr. Morrow about this time, his time in the Pacific, just before and as the war ended.
They were still fighting in Iwo Jima, but I wasn't there when they invaded Iwo Jima, but I was there when they were still fighting. They hadn't secured Iwo Jima then.
So what was that like during the Battle of Iwo Jima when you were on the Birmingham?
Well, it wasn't too good. You don't know what was going to happen. They had them suicide boats that come out and put bombs than the ships try to blow us up. Instead of a plane, they had them boats, suicide boats.
So, yeah, many people are familiar with kamikaze airplanes, right, during World War II that the Japanese used, but probably many people don't realize that the Japanese also utilized vessels, utilized boats on suicide missions, huh?
Right, right. And then later on they started, when the war was getting over, more over, and they were losing the war, they started to put these suicide planes in and try to damage everybody's, every ship, you know.
I understand that the USS Birmingham was the target of a kamikaze plane, and that you lost some crew members, right?
About 80, I think it was.
What happened?
Well, the suicide plane came in and hit and went down through three decks to the armored deck, and a 500-pound bomb exploded. And it put a hole about the size of a couple cars on the side of the ship.
Were you able to hear this kamikaze? I don't know where you were on the ship, but were you able to see it?
Well, I didn't see it, but the guy that was with me and him, we came out of the turret. We were in a 5-inch turret, and we'd take breaks every now and then to get out, and we went out to get on the main deck to get a little fresh air and stuff. And the guy that was ahead of me, he was an older guy than me, he seen it coming. And he said, come on, let's get back in the turret. Right? Well, by that time it had hit. And we never did get back in the turret. And it hit right in front of our turret. It was only about, I'd say, 25 feet from where we were.
Were you injured at all?
No. See, the bomb, when it hit the deck and went down through, it was just the plane and stuff, and nothing happened till that 500-pound bomb went off. I mean, it made a hole where the plane went down through and then exploded.
So when something like that happens, you said very early on we were talking about being thankful for still being alive. I imagine at that moment you're having the same thoughts, right?
I don't know. You were scared, but I don't know. You know, I never thought about dying. I was too young. I was only 17 years old, and that time, you know, you didn't worry about dying. You just worried about doing your job.
So the armistice was signed in August of 1945 when you were still in the Pacific. Again, probably many people think that, okay, the atomic bombs were dropped, the armistice was signed, that was it. But from what I understand, there were still a lot of people in the U.S. service, like yourself, who weren't absolutely convinced that this was the end, right?
When Okinawa was secured, they loaded our ship up with ammunition, and we were about, I'd say, 3 or 4 days out from Okinawa when they announced that the war was over. We thought we were going to, nobody told us for sure, but we had what we called scuttlebutt, and they said that they thought we were going to go to Japan. That was our next invasion.
Were you still concerned that there could be kamikazes out there or other Japanese troops?
You're right. We were.
So you were concerned that the enemy didn't know that the war was over?
Yeah. I that's what we thought, yeah.
Mr. Morrow, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today, and thank you for your service. Herbert Morrow, he's 93 years old now. Was 17 at the time in 1945 when Japan surrendered. That generation and those veterans who are still alive, it's such a treasure trove of information, and we're losing so many of those stories because so many World War II vets were losing every day. But Colonel Boos, what's your takeaway from what you heard Mr. Morrow have to say there?
Yes, it was An honor to hear him, a veteran of the war, a gunner, 5-inch gun on board the USS Birmingham, which had sustained considerable damage during the war. And he mentioned the possibility of invasion of Japan and kamikazes, and his concerns were well-founded because the Japanese had moved an immense number of forces into Japan. There were only a limited number of places where an amphibious landing could take place for the invasion of Japan. The Japanese knew where they were, and they had begun to stockpile their aircraft, was their surviving aircraft, and still thousands of aircraft which they were prepared to attack an invasion armada. So if the war hadn't ended, the invasion of Japan would have been a enormously desperate and costly undertaking.
Dr. Biddle, that leads to the atomic bombs. In the 75 years since the United States dropped those two atomic bombs, I don't know, I get the sense that a lot of people look back on it differently today, look at it as the start of, obviously, at the start of the nuclear weapon age, but look at it as the United States made a mistake, a huge mistake at the time, and started on this path of nuclear weapons, arms race, Cold War. But go back to 1945 when those bombs were dropped. We've already heard Colonel Boost. We've already heard Mr. Morrow describe about the invasion, preparations for the invasion of Japan. What was President Truman thinking, and how can we think about this overall 75 years later?
Sure, Scott. It's a very challenging, difficult piece of history. Because of the moral implications, of course, because of the devastation and destruction suffered by so many, and many of them were innocent civilians, innocent in the sense that they were young or old or not directly participating in the war. So it is something that we've wrestled with as a nation for a long time, and I think that's entirely appropriate. We should be wrestling with all of the choices that we make in war, especially if they have immense moral freight to them. But let me talk a little bit about where things were in those very trying days in the summer of 1945. We had been fighting a desperate war against Japan. We had slowly but surely ground down their naval capability by building our own ships and creating a vast fleet that we could use to take on the Japanese and their home waters and to push back their defensive perimeter slowly but surely. We had used our submarines in particular to destroy their merchant shipping, which meant it was increasingly difficult for them to get supplies into the home islands and continue the fight. And that had been particularly devastating to them. After October of 1944, they had really not been able to produce much in terms of their war economy. They were really just at that point starting to hang on, I would say. It was becoming an increasingly desperate fight because we were cutting them off and cutting off food supplies in addition. When the merchant fleet couldn't get into the home waters and resupply, Japan can't produce enough of its own food. So the people of Japan were beginning to starve. And in addition to that, we were sowing mines in the home waters so that beyond sinking the ships that were trying to come in, we would mine entrances to the home waters. And so it was almost impossible for anything to get in or out by the summer of 1945. In addition to the conventional bombing that I had mentioned, and this was unbelievable conventional bombing, when Tokyo was attacked on the night of March 9th and 10th, it had burned out 16 square miles of the city. This was completely unprecedented. And I think by the time we got to the dropping of the two atomic bombs, we weren't crossing any new moral thresholds. All those moral Rubicons had already been crossed with the firebombing campaign. This was by this time, a desperate attempt to stop the war. And as we just heard in the description of Iwo Jima and a little bit later after that, Okinawa, we were trying to get closer and closer to the home islands because we still felt it might be necessary to invade Kyushu and Honshu, to take back Japan, and to force surrender, unconditional surrender. But we were hoping perhaps it would not be necessary because we knew the cost would be terribly high, not only for Americans, but also for the Japanese people who would be fighting that fight. So we were looking and casting about for every possible way to end the war. And certainly since early in the war, we had been concerned about the possibility that the Germans, who had had, of course, brilliant science in the interwar years, might be able to take atomic energy, nuclear energy, and transform it into a devastating bomb. And this was the effort that was taking place out at Alamogordo in New Mexico to build a bomb before the Germans could. As it turned out, the Germans didn't make as much headway as we anticipated on that effort, although they made lots of headway on other fronts, including rockets and jet fighters and other things, but they didn't create an atomic bomb, but we did. And when it was ready in July of 1945, I think Truman's expectation was that we should use every weapon that we have to try to end the war before an invasion becomes necessary. And again, in the context of the bombing that had already taken place, in the context of the Battle of Iwo Jima, which had started in February of 1945, and then the even more deadly and costly Battle of Okinawa, which had started in late March, I think these bombs were viewed as simply more bombs, a new type of bomb, and one that might have shock effect on Japan, and that therefore might have a different impact on her psychologically, and thus might just be able to create a different outcome than all the conventional bombs had up to that point.
Let's take a phone call from Derek in Waynesboro. Derek, you're on the air. Hello, Derek?
This is Pat in Waynesboro.
Oh, Pat, I'm sorry. I don't know. For some reason, they called you Derek, so you have a new nickname today, Pat. Okay, Pat, go ahead.
Well, I have a very personal view of this event, and because my dad joined the Army in 1936, and he made it his career. And he had managed to stay stateside. I was born in 43. He had managed to stay stateside for most of the war. But he did end up in the Philippines in 1945. And they were bivouacked there in, I forget whether it was a sugarcane field or a rice field or whatever. And he said he remembers that all these rifle shots went off. Like, oh, my gosh, what's going on? And someone said, Japan surrendered. And so this whole situation is a very, you know, ambivalent time for me. All the loss of life on both sides. But I'm here today, and I have a younger brother born in 49 that might not have been around. Thank you.
Pat, thank you. Thank you for your father's service, and thank you for bringing a human voice to this 75 years later. You know, I think that to both our guests, Colonel Boos and Dr. Biddle, that because it is 75 years later, and there are so many people who lived during World War II that are not around anymore, that sometimes we lose that human voice, and, you know, we get to talking about numbers and strategies and battle plans and things like that. But You know, that number I gave at the beginning, 50 to 80 million people died, and there are many, many people in this country that have a connection to someone who served or maybe gave the ultimate sacrifice during World War II. So I'm sure in your studies and talking to so many people over the years that you've come into contact with so many of them, but just hearing Pat's emotion kind of brings it home, even 75 years later. You know what I mean?
Oh, gosh, absolutely, Scott. In fact... It,
yes, in fact, my father was on Okinawa at that time. If I could, Scott, I'd like to talk just a little bit about that decision. On the one hand, I think you could consider that knowing everything that was going to happen later... with after those atomic bombs, you could say that that was a bad decision, an unethical decision, an evil decision. But given the circumstances of the time, the things that Tammy mentioned, one issue was that the Japanese had established a pattern of not surrendering. And so as the war went on, the casualties became higher and higher and higher. And so as President Truman was making that decision, not only did he have the enormous cost and effort that had gone into developing the atomic bomb, but he also had these mounting casualties, over 8,000 killed in the Marianas and the Palos, just Americans, Luzon and the Philippines, over 8,000 killed, Iwo Jima, 6,800, Okinawa, 12,500. And the projected casualties for an invasion of Japan, again, were extraordinary. It's hard to see how the president could have made any other decision other than to use that weapon that was available. Some say that it wasn't necessary because the Japanese were going to surrender anyway. We know a lot more now about the Japanese deliberations. And the Japanese plan... Ketsugo for the end of the war was to make the war so costly that the United States would negotiate terms. And the terms that the Japanese were looking for in any kind of a surrender were that they would keep the emperor, there would be no occupation, they would try their own war criminals and other provisions, which the United States simply was not prepared to accept. You also have to consider what would the alternatives have been. If the war had ended with the blockade, ultimately untold numbers of Japanese would have starved to death. The bombing campaign continued. Again, incredible numbers of casualties that would have taken place as a result of continued air raids.
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Biddle, I don't think Colonel Booth heard you, and I want to get to what you had to say in response to Pat's story as well in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up next week on Smart Talk, a program on 5G technology and cybersecurity. Our guest today, 75 years to the day after Japan formally surrendered to the United States and its allies, our guest, retired Army Colonel Don Booth, former professor of strategy of World War II in the Pacific with the U.S. Army War College, the Carlisle Barracks, and Dr. Tammy Davis Biddle, professor of military studies at the U.S. Army War College, Carlisle. We only have a few minutes left. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call if you'd like to weigh in. Also on Facebook, you could leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Biddle, I don't think Colonel Booth heard you when you started before. You were responding to what Pat had to say and how emotional she got, and what an emotional day it is for families, I'm sure, across the United States, like Pat's.
Absolutely. And Scott, I think often of my grandmother, who lived through World War II, watching two sons fight the war. Her elder son, who was 6 years older than my father, went into the war very early, was stateside for a while, but then went to the Pacific, and so he was fighting in the Pacific Theater, and I'm sure my grandmother was praying every night that the war would end before my father, her younger son, had to enter the war, but that didn't happen. He entered the war in 1944, 45, fought in the European theater, but he didn't have enough points to then leave the army, so he was slated to head to the Pacific as well, and would have been probably amongst the soldiers who would have landed at Kyushu if that invasion had gone forward in November of 1945. So there's a good chance I'm here talking to you because of the fact that we managed to win that fight before that invasion took place.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so fraught, and Don gave a marvelous description of what was going on at Okinawa and Iwo Jima, and of course, in addition to the terrible casualties amongst the fighting men, there were on Okinawa in particular upwards of 100,000 civilian deaths on the island.
So 75 years later, I mean, this seems like such a small question to cover such an immense time to begin with and so many events that have occurred around the world in the last 75 years. But Dr. Biddle, the legacy of World War II and tying it into its impact even today. Again, I know that's an immense question and would take an immense answer, but can you give us kind of a brief synopsis?
Oh, sure. I mean, this was a transformative point for the United States. This is the point when we rise to great power status and really accept that responsibility. We'd had the capability before then, but the war transformed us, and we took a leadership role thereafter. We changed our idea of ourselves. We became much more outward-looking. We decided we needed to have a serious military, an increasingly professionalized military. We began to think hard about the world and our role in it. In 1943, there was a book published by Wendell Willkie, who'd gone on a tour. He was sent on a tour by the president. He went around the world. Talked to all sorts of people. That book became a runaway bestseller. The Americans were now very hungry to know about the world. After the war, or at the very end of the war, as it's culminating, we took the lead in creating the United Nations, which was a project that FDR had supported throughout the war and had been the major project of the State Department throughout the war. We funded the San Francisco Conference that brought it to life and did all the heavy lifting. In terms of creating the founding documents, we founded the World Bank to enforce a set of fixed exchange rates linked to the dollar, to create financial stability. We created the International Monetary Fund to make long-term loans for facilitating the investment of capital for productive purposes around the world and to restore economies that had been destroyed by the war. We were the dominant maritime power in the Western Pacific and indeed in the world. We had the world's largest merchant fleet. We then went on to spend $17 billion in aid to Europe through the Marshall Plan. We laid the groundwork for a globalized world, Scott. I think this is the beginning of the world that we know today. We owned two-thirds of the world's gold stocks at the end of the war and half of its monetary reserves. We commanded half of the world's total manufacturing capability. We generated more than half the world's electricity. We produced two times more petroleum than the rest of the world combined. We had a near monopoly on aviation and the electronics industries. And the American middle class more than doubled by 1960. Two-thirds of Americans were in the middle class by then. And that was in large part due to the tremendous economic engine that had been created by the GI Bill that sent American veterans to college, to become educated, and that paid huge dividends in terms of educating our population, in terms of productivity, in terms of really setting up the entire American middle class, certainly which my own family benefited from quite directly.
Now, what you just listed, so many positive things that occurred over those 75 years, but from a foreign affairs perspective, so much has changed about the world since then. We went through a Cold War. There was a nuclear arms race, probably still is.
Exactly.
What about the negative consequences of World War II?
Well, unfortunately, our Soviet ally didn't remain an ally for long after the war. We became enemies, and there was a tremendous tension between us and the Soviets because ideologically we were so different. They were had been communist before the war, remained communist after the war, and even though this marriage of convenience had helped us win the war against Hitler, we still did not see eye to eye, and so we had a long, very difficult Cold War against the Soviet Union that lasted until really the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. I think, you know, we saw coming out of the war so many fascinating technologies that would do good things. Rockets, new navigation techniques, new communications techniques. Many of the weapon systems spawned science and technology that would be very beneficial for the world. But we also had a very large buildup of atomic weapons around the world that was very frightening and very scary to live through. And that was my childhood was dominated by that, which is, I think, largely why I turned to the study of national security, because I was trying to figure out this crazy world I was living in as a child that seemed so dominated by nuclear weapons and nuclear rivalry.
Mm. And Dr. Bruce, here's a question from a listener, and our listeners, you know, these questions come in during the program, so I want to kind of take a step back here. This listener wants to know, is it true that President Truman asked Japan officials to surrender before dropping not only the first bomb, but the second one as well?
Yes, I made a reference earlier to the Potsdam Declaration in July. The United States and Britain, the Russians didn't sign that on behalf of the Allies, made a proclamation to the Japanese calling upon them to surrender, and without explicitly mentioning the atomic bomb, saying that otherwise they would face terrible destruction. And the Japanese considered this, but the as I said, their plan for ending the war was to be prepared for an invasion to make it so costly that the Americans would negotiate better terms, because we were calling for unconditional surrender. And the Japanese, in their response to the Potsdam Declaration, essentially dismissed it. And the Japanese response to the Potsdam Declaration was one of the steps on the road to making that final decision to use the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm. Colonel Boose and Dr. Biddle, we only have about 2 minutes left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. You know, one of the things that is so striking 75 years later is how close of an ally the United States and Japan is. I mean, Japan was a vicious enemy during World War II. And you look back and 75 years later, these are two of the closest allies. Japan's one of the closest allies, if not the closest, maybe other than Canada, that the United States has, and Britain, I should say. So, Dr. Biddle, what about that? I mean, it's remarkable, isn't it?
It is remarkable, Scott, absolutely. You know, and this was the case with Germany, too. We fought a terrible, vicious war against the Germans. I think the war against Japan was even more vicious. But I think not only the fact of total defeat and unconditional surrender, which was a reset button for both of these states, they realized that they could not claim that they had won. But I think really reasonable behavior by us towards our former enemies built trust. We established allied relationships. We helped them economically. We set the terms for a better relationship, and that came to fruition. But it was quite miraculous, I think, in lots of ways.
Colonel Boose, we only have about 30 seconds left. Final word on this 75th anniversary of Japan's surrender?
Well, yes, it was a momentous event, and we're still living with the legacy. There are lots of issues still unresolved from the division of Korea, the Taiwan issue, Japanese occupation of islands north of Japan, the Vietnam War, still all of those things are still legacies of the war, the benefits that Tammy mentioned, but also those fractures and splits and tensions that still remain from that long and very bitter fight.
Retired Army Colonel Don Boos, he's former professor of strategy of World War II in the Pacific with the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Dr. Tammy Davis Biddle, professor of military studies at the War College. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Scott. It's glad to be here.
Pleasure.
Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking about paid family leave.